This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. They're some of the oldest and deepest questions in science. What is the root of consciousness? What happens in mental illness? How does the brain work? Over the past century, technological advances have in turn led to major advances in our understanding of the brain. And some have declared this, the 21st century, the century of the brain, the time when we will finally unlock the secrets inside our own heads. Major American and European initiatives have set lofty goals and are pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into mapping and modeling the brain, but not everyone in the neuroscience community thinks that these two projects are on the right track. With me today are three neurobiologists and roboticists with their own ideas about how we should go about understanding the brain. Tony Prescott is professor of cognitive neuroscience at the University of Sheffield, director of the Sheffield Center for Robotics, and also the Active Touch Laboratory, co-director of the Adaptive Behavioral Research Group, and a visiting fellow at the Bristol Robotics Laboratory. John Lissman is Zalman Abraham Kext Chair in Neuroscience and Professor of Biology at Brandeis University. And Paul Verschuer is Research Professor in the Department of Information and Communication Technologies at Universitat Pompeu Fabra and Head of the Synthetic Perceptive and Emotive Cognitive Systems Research Group. Welcome all of you to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Lissman, you say that we should understand the brain like we understand any other machine. What does that mean to you?
Well, when we look at cells, we find out that the cells are obeying the laws of chemistry and physics, and we can, through a lot of work, we've understood how they communicate with each other, their action potentials, their synaptic connections. And we sort of understand all that. And then you look at the brain as a whole, and what do you find? You find billions and billions of cells. And so there's no room in our thinking these days for the concept of spirit. It's in fact these cells which make us up. And they account for the way we are. They account for our memories. They account for our goals. And as neuroscientists, we want to understand that. Now, that's threatening to some people. Are we just a machine? No, that's maybe not the way to look at it. Yes, we obey the laws of physics, but the cells do what they do. But still, in the end, all of this, all of these interactions between cells have to account for the full complexity of emotions and knowledge that we have. So we're not trying to simplify consciousness. We're not trying to simplify emotions or thought. We're just trying to understand how these cells can do it.
The U.S. Brain Initiative has as one of its goals essentially the development of technology to enable us to map the electrical circuitry, the neuronal circuitry of the entire brain. How is that kind of mapping different from what you're thinking in terms of a machine kind of understanding of the brain?
The Brain Initiative is wonderful, and we need more and more knowledge. And the Brain Initiative supports attempts to develop new methods that will add to our knowledge. The particular feeling that we, the three of us here, have is that even more rapid progress can be made largely on existing knowledge. Why is that? And that's because historically, most neuroscientists have gone off and tried to understand one little part of the brain. And they've made enormous progress. But it hasn't given us a picture of the whole brain, of how it works together as a system. And just because there's been so little attention to that issue, it's our feeling that by giving attention to that kind of question, that we can make enormous progress.
Paul Verschuer, the European Human Brain Project goes almost one step further. It doesn't just say we want to map the human brain and generate data about the brain, but we're going to actually create a computer model of the whole brain. How would you go about creating a computer model if you don't already have the data to model it on? Does that seem like a realistic thing to do?
Well, let's first look at the data gathering enthusiasm. I remember very well when I was working at the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego in the mid-90s, Joe Galli was standing there with these thick printed books with the abstracts from the neuroscience meeting. And he was sort of saying in a bit of a tired way, like, so much data, so little ideas, right? And this is the whole point, that science is about ideas. Science is about the human mind understanding the universe and changing it to the benefit of humankind and the universe. So the point is, data is only meaningful in the context of ideas. So we should first emphasize what are the ideas that we really want to advance. So that means if you just do a technology-oriented exercise to get more data, you're wasting your time. Then in the European case, it's not that they just say we're going to simulate the brain. What they're saying is we're going to do a data-driven simulation of the brain. Now, this is a discussion we've been having in the OECD Global Science Forum since the mid-90s, which targeted the question, how are we going to manage all this data that's being generated in neuroscience? And also there, the big controversy was between the database people who say, okay, we stored in a big database all these details about channels and neurons and receptors, and then we're going to switch it on in some way and sort of Jesus will be reborn. And it's just not going to happen. In the Human Brain Project, the simulation aspect of that initial proposal was very much along these lines. We're going to put all the details in our so-called simulation, and then once we run the simulation, magic will happen. So it was a very naive view.
You create robots and interactive systems that are designed, inspired by the human brain. So what is the process there? What kinds of data do you need, and do you need a complete understanding of the human system in order to create a robotic version of it?
Well, why do we work with robots? The point is, the brain is embodied. The brain doesn't exist in a vat. It sits in your skull, and it is interfaced to the world through your sensors and, in the end, your skeletal muscle system. It's embodied, and this body interacts with the world. So the point is, these signals the brain is exposed to are strongly predicated on being in the world. So for any neural model to be tested, you need to approximate those conditions. And that's why you must embody your neural model. That's where the robot comes in. But then secondly, how we see modeling as, let's say, a complementary activity to experiment. I mean, as a scientist, a scientific theory that we want to advance should explain, predict, and control. So we want to find explanations, but on the basis of those, we have to give predictions. And these predictions must be testable with current technology in the lab. So that's the loop that you're in. We're part of the empirical science loop, but we can play out scenarios in brain organization. So in the end, you have incomplete data on how different systems are organized, possibly interacting. And now you can play out different scenarios. You can say, okay, what if the cerebellum would interact with my frontal cortex in the following way? You can try out the scenario, come up with a tentative explanation, but then come out with testable predictions. So you can be wrong. The power of science is to be wrong. This modeling at this level allows you to be specifically wrong, so you learn something.
So the robots are essentially your experiment, the way that you test a theory of how the brain works, because we can't really test that within the actual human brain.
It's the way to get behavior, again, out of your model.
Tony Prescott, you also do a lot of work with sensory perception and trying to create robots that can feel, not in the emotional sense, but in the tactile sense, feel. How important is it to have both those senses and the brain working together?
So the natural world uses touch as one of its fundamental ways of understanding the world that it's in. So animals, from even simple scent animals, have mechanosensory systems, so they can sense the world through contact. And we, of course, have that all over our skin. Our skin is our largest sensory organ, if you like. So when we've been building robots up till now, we've often been working with them with sensors like vision. So we have very well-developed vision sensors. But you have a robot, perhaps, that can sense the world through vision. It can hear the world, but it doesn't sense its body or it doesn't sense its interaction with the world through its body directly. And we find that when you look at people who have impairments of their touch system, or also their ability to sense their own bodies. They're severely impaired. The people that lose that sense can't walk. They can't stand up without concentrating really hard. So if we are trying to build a robot with which to understand ourselves, we can't leave out this really hugely important sensory modality. If we can understand it and build it into our robots, then we come one step closer to understanding what we are.
I wonder how much connection there is between the biology community, where you're generating the information, and John Lissman, I'm looking at you because this is the kind of data that you've generated a lot in your career, the actual understanding of how neurons are working within the brain and how the biology works. How much connection is there between that biology community and this engineering community that can create the robots that might test those ideas?
Well, it's a growing connection, and one illustration of what's happening is that, you know, if you consider an operating system, like in the movie Her, or a computer program that sort of mimics human behavior, you could ask, well, how sophisticated is it? And you may know that in China, they've already made a very successful program that is used by, I think, 20 million people, and it responds to you. It's kind of your friend. And yet, it works in a very unbrain-like way. It in the end, is very unsophisticated. It works really by looking up in a big database who said what in a previous conversation, given the question or given the statement that was just asked. So it's really not that intelligent. You know, it certainly is true that as we understand what underlies intelligence in the brain, that this will give ideas about how to make artificial intelligence along human lines. And I think that form of human intelligence will be attractive to people.
Paul Verschoor, clearly from that example, we can create computers or robots that can do certain things, that can produce certain behaviors without being anything like the human brain. How much biology do you have to understand? How do you gain that knowledge? How do you work with biologists to create these robots in an actual human way, as opposed to perhaps just the most expedient computer way of getting a certain behavior?
Well, so there are two things here, right? So on the one hand, the robots of today are pretty stupid. There's nothing advanced about them. There's no risk of any kind of Skynet emerging or Terminators. They're just stupid machines. They're not even close to what you would expect from a bee, let's say. So in our methodology, where you say, look, I have to test my model as part of a robot because that's the embodiment of my system that gives the constraints for my experimentation, of course, in parallel, you are creating biological-like machines, machines that behave as animals would behave under those conditions. So we are just advancing that, now moving in domains of also social cognition, social interaction. That's also why we work with humanoid robots. So then you start to pose questions about, okay, what are the brain mechanisms that control social interaction? For instance, now, as we are having this conversation, there's eye contact, not too long. If humans look at each other too long, it becomes threatening. If we perform a task together, we would look at the objects at the table, there's shared attention. So these are very important social cues that we use to let's say, shape our social interaction with the world. And the questions you then pose, okay, how do brains do that exactly? So how do I actually also then model your mental content? And this is also called mind reading. So in social interaction, because maybe the answer I give you is tremendously boring, right? So at some point, I have to sort of also make that assessment, whether what I'm talking about makes any sense to you. So that means, as a social agent, I have to understand your internal model. I have to make predictions about that. So you then start to pose very concrete questions. How does a brain build a model of the world to start with? How does the brain build models of physical objects? How does the brain build models of social objects? And the big difference there is a physical object, like this little paper cup here, has no wishes. It has no goals. It has no ambitions. It doesn't want to be president of the United States. It just stands there. And when I push it, it moves. However, when this would be a social agent, then its actions and reactions would depend on its internal states that I cannot see. You see, so the point is, the questions that you raise, and also at this psychological level, translate very directly to concrete questions at neural implementation. How would a bunch of neurons linked together form a model of anything at varying levels of complexity? So this is how you would go about solving that problem, where you have a benchmark. Because now my benchmark is human social interaction. I can see how humans perform a collaborative task, and I can then say, okay, if my robot is based on principles that I hypothesize are implemented in the human brain, is it generating comparable behavior? So you have very clear benchmarks at a behavioral level, at an anatomical level, and at a physiological level. So I call that convergent validation, that models must satisfy these three sources of constraints or benchmarks. It's behavior, anatomy, physiology. If you satisfy that, you're on the right track. If you fail doing that, then it's just metaphor.
That's Paul Verschoor. Also with me, John Lissman and Tony Prescott. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more about the amazing machines inside our heads when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. With me today, Tony Prescott of the University of Sheffield and the Bristol Robotics Laboratory, John Lissman of Brandeis University, and Paul Verschoor of the Universitat Pompeu Fabra. I want to go back to your statement that robots we have today are stupid.
Yeah.
Can you define, because they can do some pretty sophisticated things.
Like what?
And they can answer, well, we have apps that you can ask a fairly open-ended question and it will figure out what that question is and what it needs to search in order to find you the answer. Or it will search a database and figure out what response you might like to whatever statement you just made to, you know, how do you define intelligent and how is that different from simply being sophisticated computing, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. I'm not a great believer in intelligence. That means, you know, the construct of intelligence goes back to the 19th century, where Galton, who was really a very nerdy kind of person who wanted to measure everything and quantify reality, decided that he needed a construct to delineate or define the differences among social classes and races. And then he invented this notion of intelligence to do that. And since then, so late 19th century, we have this incredible debate. What does it mean? What is intelligence? And because the idea was there was a single factor, the G factor, underlying that. And then it went to Binet with his IQ test and so on. But recently, Adrian Owen put people in a scanner and had them solve standard intelligence tests with the question, well, if there's a single factor underlying intelligence, there must be a single neural process underlying that as well. That would seem logical. Well, that's not what he found. When people perform intelligence tests, actually the whole brain is engaged in varying ways, depending on the specific task that you perform, illustrating that the assumption that intelligence is a unitary thing is not more than an assumption. That's slowly falling apart. So we have to be very careful what we mean now with intelligence. So if you take the example from John, which is actually a product from Microsoft, the point is it appears smart to us. But maybe it appears like that because humans have this incredible projective power, right? If I draw two eyes on my little paper cup here, you will start to project intentions onto my cup. This is what humans do. So don't forget, already in the beginnings of artificial intelligence, when Newell and Simon proposed their logical problem solver that was indeed solving logical puzzles, oh, we got it. It does it in the same way as humans do. But the point is, it's maybe this hyper-adaptability of humans that is projecting that interpretation on this technology, right? So if you take Siri, I think Siri is tremendously annoying and stupid, but we are usually very forgiving, compliant, and adaptive agents. So we incorporate it in our behavioral repertoire. It has nothing to do with this technology. It has everything to do with us.
Tony Prescott, intelligence, is there a way of defining it as a human quality as opposed to a computational quality?
I think Paul's right that there are different forms of intelligence. And I would disagree slightly that robots are all stupid.
What do you mean?
You could allow them some artificial intelligence and say that in certain arenas they've surpassed what we traditionally thought was intelligence. So, for example, the ability to play the game of chess was always viewed, certainly in the last century, as one of the epitomes of great intelligence of humans. And then chess-playing programs surpassed grandmaster level at the end of the last century. And now computer programs outplay grandmasters in chess all the time. Nevertheless, the best chess players today are teams where a human being has a computer, a chess program. So even when you have a chess-playing program that can beat a grandmaster, you add a human chess player to that, and you're adding something else. So the human being is bringing to the problem of chess something that the program hasn't captured yet. And wherever we look at AI, it's capturing one fraction of what we do, and often surpassing what we do supremely well. For instance, in remembering things, in calculating things, perhaps in estimating things very accurately. AI is doing superbly well, and search, it's doing fantastically well. So we could say that AI has surpassed human intelligence in several of these domains, but in a lot of other areas, it's way behind. And Paul's right that we are barely beginning to scratch the surface of how humans are so successful at living adaptively in the world. If you caught any of the DARPA robotics challenge recently, you saw robots whose job was really quite simple. It was to go through a door, it was to turn a valve, it was to climb a set of stairs, and then come out the other side. And these robots, which were built by teams from all over the world, and I wouldn't knock them, they were great teams, it's just a really challenging problem. And the videos of that competition showed that, for one thing, the robots move very slowly, so all the videos are speeded up 10 times. But even speeded up 10 times, they're not moving very quickly. And they fall over a lot. They fall over just trying to open a door. They fall over trying to pick up a tool. They take a very long time to do these things. And it just shows the difficulty of these problems and how far we are from getting the solutions to them. So AI has some particular things that it's really good at. And it's complementary to human beings in those areas. And people have always used technology to boost their own intelligence. So Andy Clark wrote a book about this. He called us natural-born cyborgs, is that we have always extended ourselves. And this is why we're so successful as a species, by creating tools, you know, from stone tools to bits of papyrus that we scribbled on, to phones and computers. We have used external symbol systems like computers and now like robots to boost our own intelligence and boost our own impact on the world. So that's why I'm not worried about AI superintelligence, because I think humans are always going to add something to what you can get from the computer. And ultimately also the motivation to do something is coming from the person, not from the machine.
There's another word. We've been talking about intelligence here, but I wonder if there's another word that needs to come into the conversation, because maybe this is what's missing. And is it consciousness? That there's a difference between being smart and what we think of as human consciousness. Is there even a definition for consciousness that three scientists sitting in a room could all agree on what consciousness is?
Well, probably not, but I have one. And if you don't like it, I have another one.
All right, well, let's hear them.
So for me, consciousness is a transient memory system in which you represent your own relation to the world and all its hidden states that allow you to make value judgments on your own performance.
I can more or less agree with that. But what I would say is that the problem of consciousness has, people have become a bit fixated on that. And that's partly because Paul has a decent definition that we don't generally have an agreed definition. But people generally will say there's something that is the experience I have. There's something internal, subjective, my experience. I can imagine a robot that did everything I did but didn't have internal experience. And that's the thing that we need to explain. And there are some scientists, and I think I can count themselves among them. Daniel Dennett would be a philosopher that takes this view, which say that once we capture everything that the brain does, then that will no longer be something that we need to explain. In other words, once I capture what Paul was talking about in terms of the social intelligence that the brain must have to understand what you're doing when we're having a conversation like this and to model that in my brain, once I understand what it means for my brain to perceive the world around it and also to perceive its own body, once I have a theory of that, once I put all these things together inside a robot, will the robot have a feeling of what it's like to be something? I think it probably will. Certainly, such as a robot, we'd be able to have a conversation with it, similar to the conversation we have now, and ask it about its internal states. And I dare say it would use language similar to ours to describe them. So I'm not sure that consciousness, as you might define it, in terms of this property of experience, is something that needs explaining. Daniel Dennett said that, you know, gold has the property that it glitters. You don't have to know anything about gold beyond what we know physically about gold to explain the litteriness. In other words, litteriness is not something that's added into gold. It's an essential property of gold in certain states. And consciousness might be an essential property of brains and minds when they're in certain states.
Do these concepts, John Lissman, of consciousness, does that really even enter into the biological world, or does, in terms of the researcher, or does that just seem like something that will emerge when we figure out how the brain works? Is there anything else there?
Well, as I said, we as neuroscientists can't accept a version of ourselves that is less rich than we ourselves feel it. And since we feel conscious, I feel neuroscience has to provide an answer. Well, what could that answer be? So I was listening to the two explanations, so I want to give my own.
Absolutely.
So to me, what's spectacular about consciousness is that there are parts of me that are quite effective that are not conscious. So that's very interesting. And my favorite example, one that many, many people can experience, is driving to work on autopilot while you're thinking about something else. And I think it's fair to say that experience of driving to work is unconscious. It shows something very, very important. It shows that when you when you look at a brain and you look at how sensory information is absorbed, how it gets connected to the motor system, that it does not necessarily produce consciousness. On the other hand, we have another part of us which we feel very dear about. It's us, and that's what we call conscious. And so now, as a neuroscientist, I would say, well, what's different about these two brain processes, one which doesn't give us the feeling of consciousness and one that does? And to me, just if I can finish up by saying, I like the definition of consciousness given by John Locke. John Locke said, consciousness is the perception of one's own thoughts. What does that mean from the point of view of hardware? It means that you take the thought process, which is kind of an output, and you put it back into your sensory structure. So you kind of hear yourself talk. You get a sensation of imagining what it's like if a dog would bite you. And that kind of architecture of feeding back the output of your system back into your sensory structure doesn't have to be there. But I would argue that if we understood that process in the brain, we could use it in a physical computer. And if that essential property of consciousness was inserted, the feeding back of output like speech into the sensory structure, that the computer
You think
would,
we would get consciousness?
The computer, yes.
Now, as Tony said, we could essentially test that in a robot by asking that robot certain things and expecting certain answers of it. But I wonder, we tend to think of consciousness as a uniquely human thing. Do we have any way of testing for consciousness in a biological system to perhaps see if other intelligent animals or other animals, point blank, are conscious?
Well, yes, we do, if you accept one little assumption. So the assumption that I work on is that we can equate two words that we often use, which are habit and unconscious. That is, when we do something by habit, it often, not always, is totally offline as far as we're concerned. Like driving, we drive by habit. Now, it turns out that in rats, you can identify their behavior, which in a very, very well-practiced task will become conscious, unconscious, and I mean, will eventually become a form of habit. And there's specific tests you can do of whether it's a habit. Then you find other tasks which have not become habits yet. And so if you equate the habit with unconscious and the ones that haven't become habit with conscious, then you can actually explore in the rat, let's say, their consciousness.
That's John Lissman of Brandeis University. Also here with me, Paul Verschoor of the Universitat Pompeu Fabra, Tony Prescott of the University of Sheffield, and the Bristol Robotics Laboratory. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are Paul Verschoor of the Universitat Pompeu Fabra, John Lissman of Brandeis University, and Tony Prescott of the University of Sheffield and Bristol Robotics Laboratory. Tony, we were talking earlier about the importance of perception and Paul, the importance of having not just a mind, but having it within a body that is interacting with the world and thinking about the possibility of a conscious robot, the pop culture versions of the super intelligent or the conscious robots have tended to be pretty disembodied. Do you think that's actually possible? Can you get that kind of consciousness without the full embodiment and interaction with the world?
I don't think we'll get disembodied AIs, which are consciousness anything like the way we are. I'm a psychologist as well as a roboticist and a neuroscientist. And when psychologists think about the concept of consciousness, do so in the broader context of having a self. You know, yourself is the story that you tell about who you are and that you tell to other people. It's your feeling that you're the same person you were yesterday and tomorrow. And so I take the different aspects of the self and try to recreate those in a robot. So one thing is the physical sense of your own body, for which the sensory systems are really important. We want to create that physical self sense in a robot. The other is the interpersonal self we've talked about. We can create that in a robot. And then there's the temporal self, my feeling of who I was yesterday, who I might be tomorrow. We can create a robot that might have that. Now, some of these senses of self depend on half of a body, so the physical self. But others, like an awareness of past and future, I can imagine that being in a disembodied AI. But I think generally when we create AIs in the future, they'll be very different from human selves. Even if we are starting from this position of trying to model the human brain, we will end up with machines that they will have very different kinds of bodies, different ways of interacting with the world. They will have far more effective memory systems, for instance, and different ways of sensing. So to be useful, also, these robots will be quite different from us. There's already 7 billion humanoids on the planet. Why should we build more? I think we'll build robots that maybe look more like animals or more like look like conventional machines, and they will do useful jobs for us. So when I think about future AIs, I'm thinking about things which are quite different from us that have self-awareness in some interesting and useful ways, but that don't have the full complement of aspects of the self that I think make up humans.
Paul, you mentioned earlier that you work with humanoid robots. One, I know it's iCub, I believe. Why work specifically with humanoid robots?
Well, if we start again from the conscious perspective, in the field, there are actually two extreme positions. On the one end, there's a position like Dan Dennett, Rosenthal, others that say, well, consciousness is an epiphenomenon. It's sort of some evolutionary resonance, but it has no functional relevance. Free will is an illusion, as Wagner would say and others. So it sort of explained away. It doesn't play a role. At the other extreme, we have people like Giulio Tononi and Christoph Koch and David Chalmers, who are actually very dominant in the field right now, who would say, well, consciousness is everywhere. Every atom is conscious in some microscopic way. So consciousness is a given property of the physical universe, just like charge. In other words, it's not something we have to explain either. And I think both these positions are scientifically not very useful. So we also have to pose the question, okay, what's really the function of consciousness? And this is really where we are sort of advancing our own theory in the field, where we look at consciousness as playing a very specific role in evolution. As also in the development of more complex biological systems, and in particular systems that have to guess what the hidden states of the world are. I mean, you don't like my shirt, but you're not advertising that to me. It's not written on your
How
forehead.
How would you know that?
Exactly, you see? I have to make inferences. I have to guess what you think, and Tony completely disagrees with everything I say. So this is the problem we face in the world. We have to make guesses about the world all the time. So I believe that consciousness in particular evolved when multiple agents had to start to interact together and you were in this world with hidden intentional states, with the hidden wishes and goals of other agents. So to study that, I have to build my neural models, which we do. I believe it has a lot to do with certain structures in the brain that are called the thalamus and the cortex and associated areas. But now it's also a theory about social interaction, because I'm saying the specific functional role is for a social agent. So how do I now test my theory? Well, we're saying to test my neural model, it must be embodied. But now I have to embody it in a way that it can be social. So if I want to do my experiments now with humans, I must find a human-like or an anthropomorphic embodiment. So this is where my humanoid robot comes in, because if I want to study using my robot now human social behavior, I need to start with a device that has an embodiment that humans can intuitively relate to. Right? It has two eyes, so you can have shared attention and so on. It has two hands, and we can relate to that. So the humanoid robot is just an extension into understanding social cognition and consciousness, because I see consciousness as really underlying social interaction.
There's also a point, though, at which something starts to look very close to human, but uncomfortably not quite human. So you have to somehow balance that, because we haven't gotten to the point where we can make something that looks comfortably completely human.
Sure.
So you've got to be a little bit farther off the mark.
Well, this is the famous uncanny valley that Hollywood discovered at its own peril by producing all these computer graphic movies with humans, with sort of animated humans in it that were just a little bit off, and no one really liked it. It's a well-known effect that actually goes back to Sigmund Freud, that also gave a sort of an interpretation why that would be. It's a bit like when someone has sort of an illness, or there's, let's say, a strange rash on the face or whatever, it is a bit off-putting for us, as also as a defensive reaction. So this is a massive problem. And actually for many engineers, the idea of building a social robot is, okay, let's build something that looks human. And then you see actually humans don't like it, right? So there's a whole psychological question there, right? What is, let's say, a social agent that we accept? Dogs or cats we accept marvelously well. Some people accept their goldfish as a social companion. So it means there are certain morphologies that we accept quite easily as social agents, but there's a whole science that we still have to develop about what the psychological factors are that really play a role there. Just to mimic something human-like, we know, is just not good enough. But so in the uncanny valley, you would say, okay, if it's different enough, like it looks like a Labrador that sort of looks at you and drools, that's all very cute, we think, so we can relate to that socially. But if it's like an animated human that's a little bit off, then it's off-putting. We will not accept it. It's not psychologically valid. So this is, again, a whole science we have to develop about really what are the morphologies we can create for social acceptance. In our own case, the biggest robot we created was 180 square meter, I don't know how many feet that is, a building that would interact with you and communicate with you. And when you ask humans, we had 500,000 people going through the building. If you ask people afterwards, do you accept us as a creature? The majority says yes. So yeah, there are a number of open questions there.
Well, and you have used virtual reality and interactive spaces. It doesn't have to necessarily to challenge your idea that you need a humanoid to interact with it. Mm-hmm. You use interactive spaces,
yes,
and virtual reality to help treat stroke is one, and yeah, mental illness. So so it doesn't actually have to be embodied, does it?
They're all embodied. My building has a body. It's just a building. It's a strange body. But the point is, if my starting point is human social behavior, I don't want to make my life more complicated by running my experiments with humans socially interacting with the building. There are quite some additional parameters that I have to understand then. And actually, we have done a lot of experiments on this. Like, how do humans interpret, let's say, color combinations and speed at which colors move over a floor in terms of what the emotional connotation is? But so the robot just comes in as an experimental tool, understanding human social behavior. I just need an instrument that entices humans to socially interact. And then the humanoid is a better controlled tool than to immediately jump into this ADA space, in which have so many uncontrolled aspects that you would have to investigate then.
Tony, talk a little bit about some of the ways that you see intelligent robots or virtual reality being used. You've said a few times, you don't fear the development of these robots or worry that we're going to have killer robots, but you see them being aids to humanity. So what kinds of things do you think they could do for us?
Well, right now we have people that have been fighting wars in places like Afghanistan coming back with missing limbs. So a big effort is around replacement limbs that are smart, that, you know, that can actually, you know, grip a cup for you and take it to your mouth. So one of the direct results of the kind of research that we're interested in is we can create artificial systems, artificial limbs and hands, which you can even interface perhaps to your own brain so that you could control that system almost as if it was your own hand. And that's some way off. But that's in the pipeline based on the kinds of technology that we're developing. So by directly basing our robotic science on understanding of the human brain and body, it's much closer to being able to develop prosthetic systems. So that's one big application area. Another area I see is assistive robots and companion robots. So we're faced with a situation in Western countries where society is aging. Average age of citizens is growing. And we know that as people grow older, they also have more disability. And so we want to help people to live independently for longer. And I see robots and artificial systems coming more into our everyday lives as assistive systems. I don't see these being humanoids. I see these being, we already have intelligent vacuum cleaners. I see the next stage of that.
I heard we actually now have lawnmowers.
We have lawnmowers.
Exactly. Yeah. All sorts of.
And so gradually the different elements of the home, including the home itself, become smarter and more able to help you look after yourself as you grow older. And I think that's important for, you know, my generation in 20, 30 years' time. When we reach this blip of the demographic shift, many more older people than younger people, it's about reducing the burden on them and caring for us and helping my generation to live more independently. And I'm very keen that we develop these kinds of assistive robot systems to help us do that. And of course, to be useful, these assistive robots have to have the kind of social intelligence that we're talking about. They have to be able to recognize the problems that you're facing with and know when to help and when not to help. So stupid robots won't be much use for that. We need robots that have intelligence, and some of that will be human-like social intelligence.
I understand the kinds of assistive things you're talking about, but is there not some risk associated with that? Some risk that this will go wrong in some way, that because of our incomplete understanding of the human brain and intelligence and consciousness, it will go wrong in some way that we can't predict?
I think there's a balance. So you have to think about benefits and risks, and you have to consider what's the cost of not doing something as well as the potential risk of doing it. Now, you can't predict all of the risks very easily. If we think about the internet happened. We maybe foresaw some of the things that would happen. One of the things we didn't see coming was cyberbullying, I think. But now you have, teenagers that get very distressed because they go home and they're getting cyberbullied via social networks. So we didn't see that coming when the internet was invented. So we won't be able to foresee all of the risks, but we can start thinking about what they might be. We can start designing and building these systems in such a way that we try and minimize the risks. So the ones that we can anticipate, we can try and build safeguards into these systems to stop those negative outcomes from happening. But also, to some extent, I think we're not really faced with a strong choice here, because we have companies in the US, for instance, Google, really pushing this forward. So as scientists and academics, we're contributing to this, but also I think we have a role to try and help understand the impacts and work out in advance what the potential risks could be and how we might mollify them, and work with these industrial companies to think about what they're doing and what would be the smart approach to take.
Paul, for sure, do you have robots outside of those that you work with professionally? Do you have robots in your daily life?
Well, I have these vacuum cleaners, but that's sort of standing in the corner because I think it's useless. And the point is that I think, of course, I'm less fascinated by these things because I roughly know what's going on behind the scenes. It's a bit of theater. And I feel that we are in transition. The robots we know today, the technology we know today, that's all still the past. It's technology with its roots in the Industrial Revolution of being useful. But we've lost our humanity in doing this. And I think the scientific challenge that we face, and also the technological challenges, how do we salvage our humanity? How do we actually identify what makes us human? I think our science should help us in doing that. Not about being useful to make things faster and generate more money for whomever. That's not the point. What we really have to worry about, who are we? How do we coexist with our technology of the future? And how does it make for a better society that has better human quality? And so in order to achieve that, we must base our technology and how we apply it on a deep scientific understanding of what we are and how we function. And that's lacking right now. Right now, it's more driven by market forces. Like the most advanced machine learning and search technology is used to deliver more cat videos on your doorstep more rapidly. Who cares about that? It's completely useless. We have massive problems in our classroom. The way our educational system works, it's still 19th century psychology. It's terrible. And that's a massive challenge. We have masses of children losing out a decent education because we have no fundamentals behind it. And the same holds, for instance, in the domain of how we treat people who try to recover from brain injury. It's still very primitive what we're doing there. Or if you look at domains of how we deal with, let's say, culture, our cultural heritage, our future. And I think these are the challenges we have to attack. Right now, that's not happening. And that's a shift we're facing. If we don't do that, we're going to just drown in a sort of a meaningless technology universe that's in the end will be very boring.
Tony, do you have robots in your daily life?
So I think anybody who has an automatic washing machine at home has a robot in their daily life. And I have one. And I'm old enough to remember when washing machines had a row of about 30 buttons on the front, and you had to say what the load was, how long you wanted to wash for, temperature of the water, all these other options. And now you just put the clothes in, you close the door, and you press start. And the washing machine works out for itself the weight of the fabric. It can judge how dirty the water is as it's washing. It can know how long to wash for, how long to dry for. It's a robot because it has sensors and it has actuators. It has a drum which it can rotate. So it's a simple robot, but it does a really good job for you, and it does it in your home. Your car, if you're fortunate to be able to buy a new car, you can get one that can park by itself now. And in the future, cars will have more autonomy. These are basically robotic functions. So these are coming out into the world. Current robot vacuum cleaners aren't great, but I think the next generation will do a really good job of cleaning. And in 10 years, people will laugh at you if you push your own vacuum cleaner around in the same way as people would think it crazy if you don't have an automatic washing machine. So rather than being a radical shift towards having robots in our lives, I think we will gradually see more and more robotic technology entering our lives and doing jobs for us. And after a while, it'll seem crazy that we used to do these things by ourselves. And I'm actually optimistic about the impact that this is going to have. I think finally we're going to have a situation where machines can take on the jobs that we don't want to do, the ones that are dangerous or dull or dirty, and people don't want to do this. And I don't just mean at home. I mean in places like agriculture, mining, things going off planet, visiting the moon. We send robots. And human beings will have more free time, which is all great. And we then have to think about the economics of that, how we make sure that the benefit of that just doesn't accrue to a few individuals, a few big companies, how we share the benefits across our society. And I think that's one of the big questions we have to face is wealth inequality and how that could potentially be impacted by AI and robotics and the changes we have to make politically in order to make sure that doesn't happen.
Tony Prescott, Paul Verschoor, John Lisman, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.